This is a Jewish TV channel presentation. Welcome to Talking Point, where controversial subjects are brought into sharp focus. Conversations with JTVC show host Laura Kessler comes up next.
Good evening. Welcome to Talking Point. I'm Laura Kessler. The mission of Jewish TV channel and BIPAC News is to promote bipartisan voices working together to fight the AIM syndrome, anti-Semitism, Israel-phobia, and miseducation. Sometimes it's easy to get overwhelmed doom-scrolling all the bad news online, and we give far less time to constructive action that could actually make a difference. If only emojis and forwarding emails and content actually made a dent to change anything, it doesn't. Which is why I'm especially excited to speak to my guest today, who's a professor at UC Berkeley that recently took very public action and made many of us quite proud these last couple weeks. Professor Ron Hassner is a political science professor and Helen Diller Family Chair of Israel Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a co-director of the Helen Diller Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies and the author of many books. On March 7th, he staged a faculty sit-in against anti-Semitism by living and sleeping in his Berkeley office until the university administrators finally agreed to his request to improve the environment on campus for his Jewish students who are facing unprecedented anti-Semitism. Several other faculty eventually joined him, setting off a very interesting faculty activist dynamic, and eventually the university acknowledged his request, which I'll let Ron tell you about himself. Ron, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
So first of all, you're home now, right? How long have you been home since all of this wrapped up?
So I've been home now for well over a week. I want to say it's been maybe 2 weeks, if my count is correct. I locked myself in my office, as you said. I think it was March 7, and I was there for 2 weeks.
Well, I give you credit. I think after like one or two nights, I'd be crawling to my chiropractor at that point.
It wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad. I had a decent mattress that I brought into the office, and I brought all the drugs that I could possibly need should I get backache, and it actually turned out not to be an issue.
Oh, that's good. Well, it looks like you had plenty of company and support, and you had a really fun environment with students visiting around the clock. And, tell us, what were you protesting? Why were you protesting? And what was the flashpoint for you that made you take it to that next level of camping out in your office?
Right. So I think life has been difficult for many students who have connections to the Middle East, whether they're Muslim or Jewish or Palestinian or Israeli. After October 7, I think things on campuses got really heated. And on the Berkeley campus, as at many campuses, anti-Israel protests were sort of particularly vicious, very aggressive, very confrontational, mostly verbally. That made many pro-Israel or Jewish students uncomfortable, and it's fine. It's okay to be uncomfortable on campus. That's part of what a campus is supposed to do. But here and there, and you heard about incidents at Columbia and at MIT and at Brown, protesting students got out of control and crossed the line. And that line is often crossed from just protesting and into verbal harassment or even physical harassment. What happened on the Berkeley campus was the takeover of the main gate of campus, which is sort of a system of three gates connected to each other. And anti-Israel students blocked the middle gate with ropes and chains and tables and their physical presence and used it as a place to conduct their propaganda, which is, it's fine. The protesting itself is not the issue. The blocking of the gate is illegal from a university point of view. But the real problem was that students were now squeezed through the side gates and the protesting students were harassing them. They were getting in their face. They were calling them names, taking their photos, sometimes blocking them physically. And the university didn't do anything. And because the university didn't do anything, things escalated. The protest at the gate became sort of more and more vehement. They started playing fake war sounds. They started sort of pushing their pamphlets in people's faces. And then an Israeli speaker came to campus to give a talk, and the protesters assembled a mob of 200 people, some students, some from off campus, that attacked the venue of the talk, broke a door, broke a window, and actually harmed some students. One student was choked. One student got her sort of arm pinched in a door. The police had to escape with these Jewish students and with the speaker. And that's when I really felt that things were getting out of control, and I felt the university really needed to do something. I should emphasize that the need to do something didn't catch the university off guard. So it's not like anybody on my campus thought that this was okay, or that, you know, anti-Semitism is overblown. Everybody was worried about this. They just didn't quite know what to do. And big universities move very slowly. So my goal was to light a bit of a fire under them. That was the purpose of my protest.
Well, yeah, I mean, nobody should have to deal with that. That's basic code of conduct. And I mean, it's not my understanding needing to create new policies, it's enforcing policies.
So it was both. It was both. So there were policies about things you can and cannot do when speakers come, or when it comes to freedom of movement or on campus, that weren't enforced because campus wisely did not want to get into a fight with protesters. The protesters would have loved a fight. They would have loved to be dragged away in handcuffs, and campus did not want to give them that pleasure, which I understand. But they also sent sort of a wrong signal in not doing anything. But then there's also a need for some new policies. You know, what do you do if a speaker can't give their talk? Do you invite them back? Do you apologize to them? How do you make sure that students are well informed about anti-Semitism and other issues of bias? So the campus is actually still working on coming up with some of these policies. And I was promised towards the end of my protest that process would be accelerated.
So what exactly were what were the requests you put in that you said you weren't going to stop the vigil until they did? What exactly was agreed to?
I did phrase them as requests, and there were three. The first was that the university make sure that students can walk across campus without being harassed. That doesn't mean that they need to clear the protesters away from the gate. That just means that somebody needs to be there and make sure that if harassment happens, it stops and it gets reported and students get punished. They have the right to protest. In fact, I think it's very important that they have the right to protest. But we're a very big campus with a very proud history of protest. You can protest everywhere on this campus. You don't have to block the gate and you don't have to harass people while you're doing it. So that was my first request. My second request was that if a speaker like this Israeli speaker is ever prevented from speaking on campus, that they be invited back to speak. And that actually happened about a week and a half into my sit-in. And then my third request was that some staff and some students who are responsible for other students receive training, mandatory training, in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And that training has existed on our campus. It just hasn't been mandatory. And I think it was good to have that be part of a requirement. And the university complied with all three things. Again, I don't think I invented those three. I don't think the university needed to be told that these are important things that need to happen. All my protest did was maybe accelerate the pace a little. But also, I think, and you alluded to this before, it created a forum for Jewish students and their allies to get together, to support one another, and to see that they have faculty that's backing them up.
Yeah, but what was the reaction from the other students and faculty nearest to you?
Oh, it was great. It was great. All I heard was support. Maybe there was some objection. If there was, I didn't hear it. If I ever thought that I was going to be sitting alone in my office brooding, it turned out that the exact opposite was the case. From the moment I opened my door in the morning at whatever, 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, until I kicked out the last student at 11:30 at night, the office was full nonstop with people. There was a day, I think on the fourth or fifth day, I counted 120 people had been in my office that day. They'd come
Wow.
with their
Yeah, I
friends.
saw some of the video. It looks like parties you guys were having,
It
it
did feel like a party. The atmosphere, I think, was very
was
uplifting. Someone compared it to a Shiva in this sense, in the sense that it was a serious occasion. We weren't there to party. We were there because we were concerned about something, and in fact, we were deeply worried.
Yeah.
But everybody came. Everybody came with food. Everybody came with friends, and we didn't spend the time there mourning. We spent the time there encouraging one another and sharing stories and talking about how we can change things. And I have to say, the atmosphere was really very uplifting.
Yeah, and now was there any backlash from the administration? What criticism have
None.
you gotten?
None. No, zero criticism. Both the head of my university, her title is chancellor, and her second in command, whose title is provost, they both came to my office on the very, very first day to check in on me and support me and see how I was doing. Faculty showed up all the time together with parents and alumni and just people passing through campus and rabbis and head of Jewish institutions in the Bay Area. If there was any objection, I didn't hear about, oh, that's not true. In one newspaper article that I read in the San Francisco Chronicle, the head of CARE, which is this I want to say Arab advocacy organization, claimed that I was claimed that I my protest was quote unquote weaponizing anti-Semitism, which is a lovely phrase because it implies that anti-Semitism is benign, but I turned it into a weapon. I made anti-Semitism into a bad thing, and used it to accomplish some sort of pro-Israeli goal. But the truth is, even though I head an Israel Institute and I have strong connections to Israel myself, that's not what the protest was about. The protest was about anti-Semitic abuse on campus. It had nothing to do with
Right.
Gaza. It had nothing to do with Palestinians. It only had to do with discrimination against Jews.
Right. And I mean, it even said that it mandates teaching about Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. I think it even said that
Right,
first.
because why
So,
not?
and I was reading, you were personally attacked prior to October 7th. You had some incidents directed at you personally. And I also noticed that you published a very nice letter with one of your colleagues who I think is kind of like your frenemy of sorts. Can you tell us a little bit about, it looks like the two of you got together on a united effort. Can you
So
talk a little bit about that time?
there was nothing before October 7, but right after October 7, I reached out to a Palestinian colleague who's on my campus. In fact, he's in the same building as me, because I was very worried that exactly what happened would happen, which is that protest would escalate and students would harm one another. And so even though this Palestinian colleague of mine is not somebody I, get along with particularly well, certainly not somebody I agree with in any way, shape, or form about anything, I thought we could agree about this one thing, which is dialogue on campus should be civil. Students should respect one another the way he and I respect one another. And violence has no place on a campus. And so I reached out to him with a very, very brief statement, which he and I co-signed, and then the university sent out to everybody in our name. After that, there were a few sort of minor, unpleasantness against me. But the truth is, it's not clear who that came from. There was, graffiti in one place in Berkeley and a poster put up somewhere else. And I don't particularly mind those things because, I'm an adult. So I'm not easily intimidated. It's really attacks on students and bias against students that I'm worried about, because the students are still young, they're impressionable, and there's no reason why they should feel unsafe on their own campus.
Exactly. Well, it was a wonderful letter. I saw it on social media, and I mean, I thought it was exactly the type of joint leadership that we need right now, and it's great that you're active in forming those coalitions. You know, how do we combat groupthink and really just predatory indoctrination? There's a lot of talk about different things, and I know you touch on some of this in your actual work. I was reading the Helen Diller Institute has a tagline that says, complexity welcome. I love that. Can you tell us about some of the specific academic work you do and that they do, and the approach that you guys take to Israel education especially?
Yeah, so you're asking a biased person a question here, like what should we do? I'm a teacher, and so I'm going to recommend teaching as the solution to everything, just as if, you know, if I was a farmer, I'd probably recommend eating more vegetables. You know, it's what I do. It's the only thing I'm good at is teaching stuff. And I do believe and have tried to show in my research that when you teach people, their attitudes become more moderate. And I've shown that in multiple ways. First of all, just by gauging how much students know about the Middle East versus how extreme their opinions are. And it turns out that people who know more are less extreme. And the most extreme people are really quite ignorant about basic facts regarding the Middle East. And the other thing I showed is when you show students who espouse extreme opinions, when you teach them, you know, very little information, the more you teach, the more moderate their opinions become. So in a Wall Street Journal article that came out in December, I surveyed 250, I believe, college students across the United States and asked them how they felt about this slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And I found, you know, pretty high rates of support. And then I asked them what river and what sea this slogan refers to. And you won't be surprised to hear, but you'll be dismayed to hear that most of the students did not know what the statement actually referred to. They could not name the river and the sea. They thought maybe it was the Dead Sea, or maybe it was the Red Sea, or maybe it was the, you know, just throwing around wild guesses. Then comes the interesting part. I showed them a map. That's all I did. I showed them a map of the Middle East. I showed them where Israel was. I showed them where the Palestinian territories were, and showed them that this statement, from the river to the sea, is not compatible with a common future for Israelis and Palestinians. And as soon as I did that, two-thirds of the participants changed their mind and moved away from the slogan, from the river to the sea. And that's all it took, just one map. It's very little effort, because they had never seen a map. And so all they needed was sort of some basic facts. And that's really the goal of our institute on the Berkeley campus. I'm one of the people running the Helen Diller Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. It's now the largest Israel institute in the United States. We bring half a dozen to a dozen Israeli professors from Israel to California every year, and they teach on our campus all year long, multiple classes to hundreds of students. And those classes are serious, professional, careful, nuanced classes. That's very important. It's crucial that we don't conduct propaganda, and we don't try to persuade people of anything, and we don't take a political line for Netanyahu or against Netanyahu. We just teach people about Israeli history, Israeli society, Israeli demographics, law, gender, protest movements, philosophy, poetry, whatever it is, because I really do believe that the more people know about Jewish history, Jewish peoplehood, Israeli history, Israeli peoplehood, the more careful they will be in their behavior and in their statements, in their politics.
Now, what's that survey you talked about? Is that the same one that I believe I read 10% thought that Yasser Arafat was the first prime minister of Israel? Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah. That's the same survey. So, you know, people's ignorance is there's no limit to how little people know. And in a prior survey, I asked some of my best students where in relation to Lebanon the Palestinian territories were, It was a multiple choice question, north, south, east, or west. And, you know, people just guessed. And so a quarter of them guessed that the Palestinian territories were west of Lebanon, meaning they had never, ever seen a map of the Middle East, ever, which is fine. You know, you could ask me hard questions about the geography of Tibet or the geography of Nicaragua, and I probably won't know the answer either. But then I don't stand in the middle of my campus and scream free Tibet, because I don't know anything about Tibet. So you know, that's my problem. My problem is calling for genocide, which is what From the River to the Sea is. It's a call for genocide, without knowing that that's what you're doing. So all you need to do is teach people a little, and you quickly find out that many of them, not all of them, there are extremists and there are crazy people. But I would say, you know, a solid 99% of the students on my campus are smart and want to know more. And if you teach them information, their opinions moderate significantly. And that's true not just for Middle East politics. It's also true for Jewish history. Part of what makes Berkeley great is lots of first-generation students, lots of students who you know, either didn't grow up in the United States or don't speak English as their first language, come from all sorts of educational backgrounds, some of them from very poor educational backgrounds. You know, how are they supposed to know about the persecution of Jews in the Middle East, or the expulsion from Spain, or you know, blood libels in 19th century Poland? I mean, you can't expect them to know these things. And so you can't expect them to understand basic elements of anti-Semitism and Jewish history that are baked into your and my DNA. They're completely obvious to us, and they're mystifying to others.
And a lot of American Jewish students don't necessarily even know their own history, you know, which doesn't help things. You know, I love that you're taking that kind of classic traditional liberal approach to listening to all sides. You know, I think most people I know on either side of the aisle, you know, would say, let's go back to that. That was working. We did pretty well.
Yeah, which is a good point. Which is a good point. I mean, the danger I see, the opposite of what I just proposed, is bigotry, not just on the bigotry and extremism, not just on the right, but also on the left. I think you correctly identify my position as a liberal, that I want to expose people to as many different ideas as I can in the hopes that the best idea will win and they will make up their own mind about what the best idea is. But that is coming under increasing pressure, both from very biased conservative side and now from a very biased progressive side that thinks that ideas you disagree with are dangerous and that you should control what kind of words people use and what kind of information they are taught. So the big protests, the big efforts to shut down speakers on my campus do not come from conservatives. They come from progressives who are trying to cut off speech and silence it. That's the biggest challenge I see on my campus.
And so what is the solution to it? There's a lot of talk about DEI, a lot of talk about the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. There was just a report from AMCA Initiative about an 1,100% increase in faculty activism at all the UC campuses. All have Faculty for Justice in Palestine chapters now, which are giving kids extra credit for attending rallies, canceling classes. There's medical schools in the UC, not your school, but within the complex, doing some, you know, crazy, unorthodox things that, you know, need to be called out. It's like a numbers game. You know, it's like, sure, if we can set everybody aside, show them a map, they'll be moderate, right? But there's like so many of them and so few of us, and it's getting scarier to come out. So, you know, with all of that, what's the best way when we're dealing with this? It's like global macro gaslighting, and our kids, your students, are on the front lines, and not all of them are.
I wouldn't put this as a them versus us. I think most faculty members on most campuses are responsible, professional, serious individuals and serious teachers, and most of them teach things that have nothing to do with them, at least anyway. Two gut responses to what you just asked. The first thing is, if there are faculty who are organizing in order to express some opinion about the Middle East, I guess anti-Israeli opinion or anti-Zionism, there's nothing stopping from other faculty members organizing the other way. I think that's fine. I think networks are important. I think it's important for example, Jewish faculty and pro-Jewish faculty on campus to know one another and to be able to lean on one another, so that when there's problems, when there's a need for activism, when there's a need to mobilize, they can, you know, they can identify one another. In the days after the October 7 attack, when some students on our campus, other campuses, marched through campus with their fists in the air, shouting, you know, globalized intifada and glory to our martyrs, 350 faculty members on the Berkeley campus signed a letter together in which they expressed outrage at support for Hamas and condemned the October 7 attacks. And we couldn't have done that. We did that in 48 hours. We couldn't have gotten those 350 signatures if we hadn't known one another. So I think that's good, and I think that's really easy to do. That's one thing. And then the other thing is the university has to abide by its rules. Two rules come to mind specifically. The one is you don't interfere with speech. Doesn't matter whether it's a guest lecturer or a local professor. And if you have to surround them with police, then you surround them with police. But you make sure that people who come to speak can speak, and that the cowards don't get an opportunity to heckle them and prevent them from speaking. And then the other important university rule is there are certain restrictions on academic freedom, including you may not launch into political speech in a class that has nothing to do with that political topic. A computer science professor can't suddenly give a sermon about Gaza in the middle of a computer science class. And a professor may not award credit or encourage students to take any kind of political action. Neither encourage
is
nor
that
discourage.
New? This is new or already happening?
No. It's not new at all. It's not new at all. And it's a rule that holds in all universities. The question is, how well is it enforced?
Right.
To have it enforced, students have to report that there are shenanigans happening in class. And then I would say in 100% of cases, the university clamps down on that behavior. That doesn't mean that they fire the professor, but it certainly means that, the professor is admonished and warned. And if the behavior repeats itself, then they might be in trouble. There are some borderline cases here, right? I mean, are you really going to reprimand a professor who on the day after the elections says, oh, gee, you know, what a sad day for America? I don't know. They probably shouldn't say that, but that's probably not worth firing somebody for. But encouraging students to participate in a specific protest for a specific cause, that's not cool.
Yeah. No, you seem to have a really even hand about IRA, and I know in our previous conversation, I got the impression you do support it. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I would definitely support it. I don't see the problem with the IRA definition at all. And I'm kind of puzzled by people who do. I've spoken to some colleagues whose biggest concern with anti-Semitism definition seems to be that they do or don't allow enough Israel criticism. That doesn't strike me as the big problem with anti-Semitism in America today. The biggest problem with anti-Semitism today is not that there isn't enough Israel criticism. The biggest problem with anti-Semitism today is anti-Semitism today. And I think the IRA definition is now the most widely accepted by the U.S. government, by most institutions. And I think universities who take themselves seriously should adopt that definition.
Yeah, I obviously agree. I'm a pretty big IRA enthusiast. What do you want our viewers to do to support the work you're doing? And really, even more importantly, what would you say to other faculty? I know there's this new faculty against anti-Semitism movement that was just started by Academic
Yep.
Engagement Network and other things. You know, what I think is so nice about what you've done is you've You've shown that it can be done with civility. It can be done in a bipartisan or nonpartisan way. And, you know, you did it in a generative way, and you got somewhere. So what action steps, because we like to take action, what can people do to support you or to do things wherever they are?
I very much liked your statement at the beginning about, you know, don't send out another letter and sign another protest statement, but actually do something. So several things you can do. If you are a student or a faculty member or a staff member on a campus, form a network. Find out who the other people are. Campuses are very often large and very diverse. So if you're in the humanities, see if there's maybe a physics professor or somebody in the medical school or somebody in the journalism school who shares your interests, shares your concerns, somebody who you can lean on and they can lean on you and you can work together. So I think that's straightforward. For outsiders, I think people off campus, I think it's very easy to give to organizations like Amcha and Stand With Us, who purport to support students. I don't want to undermine their activity. I have not seen a lot of evidence that these organizations are making campus better in some way, although they are certainly beating the war drum and they're mobilizing people and they're giving expression to anger. So if that's what you want to do, then you support those organizations. If you actually want to make students' life better, I would support on-campus organizations that support students on campus. Chabad, Hillel, my Institute for Israel Studies, Berkeley Center for Jewish Studies. These are places that teach students. These are places that feed students. They provide a sort of social environment in which students can meet one another and can meet with supportive faculty. So they provide sort of a home for students in many ways, opportunities and networks. That's who I would support. And because they're on campus, their impact on students is more direct.
So you're in favor of the resident life, and that makes sense from your perspective. And in perspective, I think Stand With Us and Amcha Initiative, they do a lot of reports that members of Congress, for example, use the research, and I know that's what some of those things are aimed for.
Yeah,
not so much
but,
the hands-on, but yeah, I love what
you mentioned the academic exchange network. You mentioned the academic exchange network, and they're also quite helpful. They've given me the impression that their recent initiative is somewhat inspired by my protest. And this idea I had of putting a light in the window of my office. So I'm very happy that it is now spreading to others because, as you said, it's non-confrontational, it's not aggressive, it's not partisan. It's simply a way to support students and gently encourage administrations to take action on an issue that is already important to them.
Exactly. Well, you're being a role model, and it's inspiring other people. It's really great that they can do that, and we'll post some stuff on the episode page if people want to look up those networks and get involved or recommend to their professors and whatnot. But really appreciate all of this, Ron. Do you have time? You have a couple minutes to do our quick lightning round before we wrap up?
Sure, gladly.
Okay. Why are you proud to be a Jew?
I'm reminded of an old joke that if I weren't proud, I'd still be a Jew, so I may as well be proud. Why am I proud to be a Jew? You know, as a scholar, I'll say because Jews have accomplished amazing scholarship. They've contributed tremendously to revealing the world to people of all backgrounds. That's one good reason to be proud of being a Jew.
Who are your Jewish role models?
Oh, boy, that's hard. Certainly my family members, my parents, my grandparents. I've had some great Jewish mentors now and in the past who I've looked up to. I would say too many to count.
What concerns you most about the present moment in relation to the Jewish people?
I think that now, as in many points in the past, some Jews who feel the threat of anti-Semitism most fiercely try to respond to it by distancing themselves from other Jews, by denying their Jewish identity, by denying the right to Jewish self-determination, meaning Zionism. And I think that is, as always in history, a very unfortunate tendency because it doesn't work, and it undermines the safety of the Jewish people as a whole. So I remain hopeful and very optimistic about the relationship between American Judaism, Israel, and the Jewish community worldwide, acting together as one body to ensure their continuity and their future.
What makes you mad?
Jews who use their Judaism as a weapon against other Jews, so-called as a Jew, whose only Jewish identity, it's not attending a synagogue, it's not following Jewish practices, it's not reading Hebrew poetry or literature, it's not traveling to Israel, it's not any kind of relationship with the broader Jewish body politic, it's just criticism of other Jews, criticism of Israel, that upsets me.
I think a lot of people would agree with you on that one. For those who look up to you, what do you want them to remember?
The value of free speech, the beauty of liberal ideas, the fact that if you introduce into a room multiple opinions, multiple ideas, the best idea will win. And therefore, you have nothing to fear of speech. You have nothing to fear from dialogue. You should be spending your time with people who disagree with you.
And finally, what's your outlook on the future? Are you hopeful?
Always hopeful, always tremendously hopeful. I see the next generation of Jewish kids who are smart and confident and well-educated. On my campus and in other campuses, they're kind of sick and tired of being condescended upon, of being excluded from dialogue by, for example, DEI initiatives that sort of minimize Jews and push them aside. And that stand up for themselves and speak very, very proudly. So I'm tremendously hopeful.
Dr. Ron Hassner, thank you for your time today and for the advocacy you're doing for your students and for being a role model to many people on many levels. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on your program.
Well, that's it for this edition of Talking Point. Visit our social media and subscribe to our mailing list. And tune in next time as we sit down with the American Jewish Medical Association to discuss the disturbing rise of anti-Semitism in medicine, as well as our medical schools. For Jewish TV Channel and BIPAC News, I'm Laura Kessler. Stay safe, happy Pesach, and see you next time.